Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Nehemiah chapter 4. I'm going to do verses 1 through 23, which I will call Progressing in Rebuilding the Wall in Spite of Opposition. Our last chapter, our context, was chapter 3, and in that chapter we saw Nehemiah apportioning the task out for each section of the wall, and he tells who built each section of the wall. So now we start in Nehemiah 4, verses 1 and 2. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious. He mocked the Jews before his colleagues and the powerful men of Samaria and said, "What are these pathetic Jews doing? Can they restore it by themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they ever finish it? Can they bring these burnt stones back to life from the mounds of rubble?" Well, all those rhetorical questions we are going to see that in reality were answered with a resounding yes, they can. Now, who was the Sanballat? Well, he was one of the governors of Samaria, the former northern kingdom of Israel, right to the north of Jerusalem. Sanballat was already upset with Nehemiah just for coming to Jerusalem. We read in Nehemiah 2, verses 9 through 10, "I, Nehemiah, went to the governors of the province west of the Euphrates River and gave them the king's letters." Now, this province included Syria, Phoenicia, Samaria. "The king had sent army officers and cavalry to be with me, to be with Nehemiah. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, they were very upset that someone had come to give the people of Israel so much assistance." So Sanballat was on the alert from the very beginning. As we talked about in chapter 2, Sanballat was originally a Moabite from Horonaim or Horon, which is in Moab. He had now moved from Moab to Samaria, and he was the governor of Samaria now. Now in verse 1, Sanballat heard that we, the Jews, were rebuilding the wall. The progressive tense, the ing tense, shows that the wall was only partially finished. We drop down to verse 6 in Nehemiah 4, and we read this: "So we, the Jews, rebuilt the wall until the entire wall was joined together up to half its height." Half its height. For the people had the will to keep working. So the wall was only half finished here. So right in the middle of the rebuilding, Sanballat heard about the rebuilding and got extraordinarily angry. In verse 2, he calls the Jews pathetic. Now, he had already ridiculed the Jews at the start of the rebuilding of the walls. In Nehemiah 2:19, we read this: "When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about this, they mocked and despised us and said, 'What is this you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?'" So they mocked at the beginning of the rebuilding of the walls. They mocked when the walls were halfway up, making fun of the Jews. But John Gill says that although Sanballat was mocking outwardly, inwardly he was rather afraid of the Jews. But he calls them pathetic. The Jews were weak with regard to numbers and wealth. That's true, but they also had the edict of Artaxerxes behind them, as Sanballat well knew. So perhaps he was mocking in a way that shielded his interior fears. Now Sanballat ask in verse 2, "Will these Jews offer sacrifices?" Now, Sanballat was not referring to the daily morning and evening sacrifices. As John Gill points out, the Jews had been offering those for a while. He was talking about special sacrifices at the dedication of the walls, which of course would have religious significance, and of course these ancient Near Eastern people give great weight to that sort of thing. Then in verse 2, Sanballat says, "Will they finish the wall?" Yeah, they've started rebuilding in it, but will they finish it? Because, like a lot of people, Sanballat might have thought that the Jews were like a lot of people who start things but don't finish them. And then he says in verse 2, Sanballat does, "Can they bring these burnt stones back to life?" He's referring to the walls of the city which had been burnt down during the Babylonian invasion in 586 BC. And by the way, our dates now, we are just around 444 BC when Nehemiah came back to build the walls. Now the stones were burnt, and so that little adjective there, burnt, was added by Sanballat to show how the Jews going to finish building this wall. The stones are burnt. But he does bring up an interesting question, which I don't have the answer to. Where did the stones come from that the Jews used to rebuild the wall? The Jews could not have used the burnt stones, the stones that the Babylonians burnt, because limestone gets softened by fire and loses its durability, according to Kyle and Delitzsch, and that was the building material back then, was limestone. So Sanballat actually here asked a very good question. How are they going to rebuild the wall with burnt stones? Where are the Jews going to find stones to rebuild? Well, I would think that's a logical question, so I looked at all my commentators, and none of them deigned to think it was important enough to answer. So I am left to speculate that the Jews just had to go out and cut more limestone rocks from whichever quarry was available to get rocks for the wall, and that's a lot of work. They finished it in 52 days. Half of their workers had to be used for defense. So how did they do this exactly? That's a question I don't know the answer to. We go to Nehemiah 4, verse 3. Then Tobiah the Ammonite, who was beside him, beside Sanballat the Moabite, Tobiah said, "Indeed, even if a fox climbed up what they are building, he would break down their stone wall." Now, a fox is a very light animal, and so this is hyperbole here. Even if a little light, tiny fox climbed up on the wall would fall down because the materials were so bad or because the work had been so poorly done. Now, this was an apt analogy. As Gill points out, Jerusalem had been desolated in 586, and since then there were a lot of foxes running around Jerusalem. In Lamentations 5:18, Jeremiah says, "Because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate and has jackals prowling in it." And if there were jackals there, I'm sure there were foxes too. So again, the pagan enemies of God mock the people of God. Nehemiah 4, verses 4 through 5. "Listen, our God, for we are despised." This is Nehemiah speaking here. He's offering up a prayer. "Listen, our God, for we are despised. Make their insults return on their own heads, and let them be taken as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their guilt, or let their sin be erased from your sight, because they have provoked the builders." Now, as soon as I read that, I think, that's an imprecatory prayer, and, you know, that's not Christian. Nehemiah should have turned the other cheek. He should have just let Tobiah and friends and the Samaritans come down there and wipe the Jews out, because that's the loving thing to do. Well, that sounds like some wussy-pussy evangelical, but Nehemiah was not a wussy-pussy evangelical. But it has been noticed by the old commentators that does sound like a plea for revenge, and that's ungodly. But as John Gill points out, this is a cry for justice, not revenge. I point out that Nehemiah never would have made this imprecatory prayer if his enemies hadn't threatened the Jews. This is what Jameson Fawcett Brown says, quote, "The imprecations invoked here may seem harsh, cruel, and vindictive, but it must be remembered that Nehemiah and his friends regarded those Samaritan leaders as enemies to the cause of God and his people, and therefore as deserving to be visited with heavy judgments. The prayer, therefore, is to be considered as emanating from hearts in which neither hatred, revenge, nor any inferior passion, but a pious and patriotic zeal for the glory of God and the success of his cause held the ascendant sway." Well, I hope that's true, that Nehemiah wasn't hoping for revenge. He was just hoping for justice. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. If it is sinful to have personal feelings of disgust towards your enemies, and that's real easy to do, but there is nothing wrong for praying for the destruction of evil. I pray imprecatory prayers on the woke fools, anti-Christian, anti-Christ, who have taken over the culture of America and who are threatening to persecute the church. We're right on the verge of persecution. I pray imprecatory prayers on them all the time. I pray imprecatory prayers on woke corporations that try to groom kids to sexualize them, or turn them into homosexuals or transvestite or transgender people. I pray that God will send his justice on their heads. Now, I don't hate these people. I hope that a lot of these people get saved, but some of them aren't going to get saved. Some of them are in the elect, some of them are not, and the ones that are not in the elect are wreaking havoc upon civilization itself, including non-Christians. So, anyway, I don't have any problem with Nehemiah calling down wrath on the heads of the Samaritans. He says, "I want them to be taken as plunder to a land of captivity. A new Assyrian empire needs to rise from the ashes and take off these Samaritans and take them into captivity." So, I have no problem with that. Verse 5, he says, "Do not cover their guilt." In other words, let their sin be judged. Well, having said all that, and I think quite convincingly, I must give you a counter opinion from our old Arminian friend, Adam Clark. who says this, quote, "A prayer of this kind, understood literally, is not lawful for any Christian." Oh, so I guess Adam Clark, Mr. Arminian, has just said that I am unlawful. I am praying unlawful when I pray for doom to come on the heads of the woke Antichrist in America. Well, this is an opinion and an editorial comment here. I think that Arminians are not quite comfortable with the idea of the justice of God. They're constantly saying, oh, but God's a God of love. He wouldn't judge anybody. Oh, yes, he will. And it's all right for Christians to pray for God's will and judgment. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that as long as you don't get into private revenge, especially when you're talking about governmental matters. I mean, yeah, Jesus said turn the other cheek, but that was talking about private relations. How about when he told his apostle through the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of Jesus Christ, Paul the Apostle wrote Romans 13, and he said, let the government do the job that it was called to do by God, which is to visit fear into the hearts of evildoers and to wield the sword. Now, what do you do when you wield the sword? A government kills people. I can see now Nehemiah saying, oh, well, Yahweh, we need to just turn the other cheek before the Samaritans. No, that's absolute nonsense. Because people do not distinguish the private from the public, the governmental from the personal, there's all kinds of confusion on this issue. So these prayers are okay. These imprecatory prayers are met as long as certain conditions are met. One, the prayer is in self-defense only, and there is no revenge involved. The punishment is temporal, not eternal. I would never pray for somebody to go to hell. That's not the kind of imprecatory prayer I think that we've got the right to do. But as far as in this world, yes, sir, I think there's nothing wrong with that. The third condition, if you're going to pray a prayer like this, is you should have no personal animus towards the enemies. It is a matter of execution of justice. The person who pulls the switch on the electric chair should have no hatred toward the person who is suffering his condign punishment for having murdered somebody. Well, Adam Clark, since he doesn't like these imprecatory prayers, he says the translation should be this way. The verb should be translated as declaratory instead of imprecatory. In other words, Nehemiah says this, their insults will return on their own heads. They will be taken as plunder. That's not what it says. I don't know Hebrew, but I just can't believe that that's what it says. I don't know of any translation that translates it that way. Their guilt will be covered. In other words, okay for God to do it, but not okay for us to pray that God will do it. We go down to Nehemiah 4, verse 6. Nehemiah continues, so we rebuilt the wall until the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had the will to keep working. Now, this is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. The word height is in brackets. It's not in the original text. So literally, the verse would mean, so we rebuilt the wall until the entire wall was joined together up to half of the wall. Well, that leaves open the possibility that Nehemiah meant the wall was built halfway around the circuit, up to the full height. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because in our last chapter we went to great lengths showing how Nehemiah had apportioned the work along the whole circuit of the wall, starting at the sheep gate in the northeast and going all the way around to the sheep gate again. So everybody's working on every section of the wall. They're not working on half the circuit of the wall. So this is, it's halfway up. They're working their way up all the way around the world, and they got it halfway high. This verse, for some reason, as Adam Clark points out, is completely omitted by the Septuagint. We go to Nehemiah 4, verse 7. When Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, Ammonites, and Ashdodites heard that the repair to the walls of Jerusalem was progressing and that the gaps were being closed, they became furious. Now the Arabs, that could refer to anywhere in the desert between the Euphrates and the Jordan River, let's say all the way up in the north, starting right south of Damascus and going all the way south down to the Persian Gulf, that's Arabia. And then if you keep going past the Persian Gulf on your east and keep going down to the tip of Saudi Arabia, that's Arabia. And then if you, once you go down to the tip, going back up to the tip of the Persian Gulf, and if you go west and go across the southern part of Israel, across Mount Sinai, across the Shur Desert, across that piece of land that separates Egypt from Israel at the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea, that's Arabia too. So that could refer to anywhere. It could refer to these wandering Bedouins that are famous for wandering around the Arabian Desert. But all of these people are listed to show the extent of the opposition to the Israelites and to show how outnumbered they were. We've got Sanballat. He's governor of Samaria to the north, the former northern kingdom of Israel. Tobiah, his fellow official there. The Arabs that I just mentioned. The Ammonites. These were the people, if you're north of the Dead Sea and you cross the Jordan River going eastward, that's roughly where the Ammonites are. It's where the tribe of Gad used to be. Of course, Gad's wiped out now, but that's where the Ammonites are. The Ashdodites refers to the city of Ashdod, which is, it formerly was a Philistine city on the coast, on the Mediterranean coast. It was near the coast, about 10 miles north up the coast from Ashkelon, another Philistine city that was on the coast of the Mediterranean. Now, I don't know if the Philistines are still around at this late date. I think they've probably disappeared by now, but whoever was living in Ashdod, they weren't happy with the rebuilding of the wall. They saw that the walls of Jerusalem were progressing, going upwards, and that the gaps were being closed. The Babylonians, when they knocked the wall over, obviously they're not going to take time to knock the whole wall down. All they need is gaps so that they can run through the gaps and start plundering and killing and raping and burning the houses down. They don't need to knock all the walls down. And so there were still some walls that were still up. And by the way, that helps a little bit with the problem of where they're going to get the building stones to fit to build the wall. They didn't need to build the whole wall again. They just needed to fill the gaps. Well, they were furious, verse 7 says. Why were they furious? Well, they had just finished mocking the Jews. They're not going to build that wall. Well, they were building the wall. And, of course, this is going to give the Jews political clout there in the region because they have a powerful city, Jerusalem, which is way up on, it's up on a hill, walled, very hard to beat. And that means great political power in the ancient Near East to have a walled, fortified city. And so all these people thought that they were going to be subjugated by the Jews, all of whom had favor from the Persians. We go down to Nehemiah 4, verses 8 through 10. They, that means all these pagan enemies of Israel that I just talked about, they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and throw it into confusion. So we prayed to our God and stationed a guard because of them, because of the enemies, day and night. In Judah, it was said, the strength of the laborer fails since there is so much rubble. We will never be able to rebuild the wall. This makes me recall the days of dealing with the name it and claim it folks, the blab it and grab it, scream it and redeem it, mark it and park it, confess it and possess it people. Word faith, they call it now, people call it now. This is a negative confession, folks. We will never be able to rebuild the wall. Well, they made the negative confession, but guess what? They did rebuild the wall, so what can we say about Kenneth Copelandism? Well, I tell you what we need to say about it. Kenneth Copelandism, Copenhagenism, needs to be thrown into the trash pit, and it needs to go buzzing off into the footnotes of history. Now, notice that the Jews did not merely depend upon God's supernatural providence to protect them. They took natural means, which, of course, we should always do. God always works through the natural before he resorts to the supernatural, before he resorts to miracles. And so Nehemiah stationed a guard. And, of course, the natural and the supernatural are never in opposition. They both work to carry out God's purposes. But apparently here, there was demoralization everywhere, because in Judah it was said. In other words, that was the general opinion running around through the ranks. Everybody was demoralized. The strength of the laborer fails. In other words, we don't have enough manpower to finish this wall. There's so much rubble. Everything's torn down. It's just, by sight, looking at it, it's impossible. Well, that's the way it always is. God expects us to operate out of faith. He expects us to believe his word, no matter how bad things look. Recall Peter walking on the water. It looked bad. There was a storm. He's walking on water. And Jesus expected him, to look at Jesus, and to walk on the water. That's just the way it is in the Christian life. Now, looking at the situation in the natural, the Jews had every reason in the world to be discouraged. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and point my fingers at them and say, oh, you don't have any faith. I'm not a Copenhagenite. I empathize with these people. But God in his mercy and his grace rescued the day. We go to Nehemiah 4:11. Nehemiah is still talking and he says, and our enemies said they won't know or see anything until we're among them and can kill them and stop the work. They won't know, Nehemiah says, is because the enemies are contemplating a sneak attack. Maybe at night they'll come on the Jews when they're least suspecting, and they will kill the Jews and stop the work. You might ask, well, now, why would the enemy say the Jews won't know or see anything until we're among them. How can the enemies be among the Jews if the wall is there? Well, the wall's only half high, remember? All they got to do is climb over the wall. We go to Nehemiah 4:12. When the Jews who lived near them had come to us from one place after another and had told us 10 times over that they were about to attack us. Now, these Jews, of course, are Jews that are not living in Jerusalem. Remember, the exiles returned. They didn't all go to Jerusalem. They went back to Israel, or Judah, southern Israel, and they didn't just go to one city, Jerusalem. Now, these Jews who were living outside of Jerusalem came from all over, all around Jerusalem, and all of them had the same word. They're about to attack you, Nehemiah. Now, these Jews who lived all outside of Jerusalem were well-positioned in such a way that they had intelligence that the Samaritans, the Arabians, and the Ashdodites, etc., the Ammonites, they had murderous plans. They had their ear to the ground. And since these Jews were coming from one place after another, from all over the place, from all directions, that means the enemy is going to come at you from all directions, because Jews in every direction had word, hey, they're coming after you, Jews. So Nehemiah is in a deep doo-doo. Nehemiah 4, verses 13 through 14. So I, Nehemiah, stationed people behind the lowest sections of the wall at the vulnerable areas. I stationed them by families with their swords, spears, and bows. After I made an inspection, I stood up and said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, don't be afraid of them. Remember the great and awe-inspiring Lord, and fight for your countrymen, your sons and daughters, your wives and homes. That's a win-win for the Gipper speech right there. Why did Nehemiah station people behind the lower sections of the wall? Because that's where it's easy to climb over. And the enemies could climb over and attack there, so this was prudent military precaution here. And he armed the people who were at these low sections with swords, spears, and bows. These were weapons that could be used both at close range and at mid-range and at far range. The closest range weapons would be swords. In case people got over the wall, you could stab them. Intermediate range, that would be spears. You could throw a spear, maybe stab a few before they got to the wall. And bows, you could shoot a long way away and nail some enemies that way. So he's pretty well prepared. I assume that the Persians allowed them to carry weapons with them as they came back from Persia, came back from Babylonia in Persia. Verse 14, Nehemiah says, after I made an inspection, I stood up and said to the nobles, that's probably the rich people, the leading people, not necessarily in the government, but private individuals. The officials would be people in the government. The rest of the people would be the common folks, the tradesmen, the laborers. In other words, he addressed them all. He says, don't be afraid of these guys. Remember the great and awe-inspiring Lord. And of course, that is the way that you rid yourself of fear, is remember God. And I tell you, in this world, there is always going to be something to fear, if I might make an application point here. And the way that you conquer the fear is that you remember the great and awe-inspiring Lord. And then Nehemiah tells the Jews to fight for your countrymen, your sons and daughters and your wives. Folks, when the enemies came over that wall, if they did, they would rape these Jews' wives and they would rape their daughters. You can count on it, because that's what happens in the siege of cities. The women are always raped. And so Nehemiah is asking the men, you're fighting for your wives and your daughters, as well as your sons and countrymen, of course, in your homes. That's important, but your daughters and wives too. They're going to get raped. We go down to Nehemiah 4, verses 15 through 18. When our enemies heard that we knew their scheme and that God had frustrated it, every one of us returned to his own work on the wall. From that day on, half of my men did the work while the other half held spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers supported all the people of Judah who were rebuilding the wall. The laborers who carried the loads worked with one hand and held a weapon with the other. Each of the builders had his sword strapped around his waist while he was building, and the trumpeter was beside me. Now in verse 15, Nehemiah states that the enemies of the Jews had heard that the Jews knew their scheme. In other words, the plan for a sneak attack had been discovered because of the intelligence of all the Jews living around Jerusalem had come in and had informed Nehemiah. And so the surprise attack is off. God had frustrated that scheme, Nehemiah says in verse 15. God had frustrated the scheme, and through natural means, of course, Nehemiah had now militarily fortified the Jews. And so this had been reported back to the pagan enemies. And they knew now that if they're going to come in, they're going to have a fight on their hands. They never did come in. The military weapons that were used here are mentioned again. Some offensive, some defensive. The bows for long-range shooting. The spears for intermediate-range shooting. The swords aren't mentioned here. But, of course, they had swords. That's both offensive and defensive. Armor was for defensive purposes. And of course, the bows and the spears were for offensive purposes. So they were well-armed. Now, in verse 16 and verse 17, the people working on the walls worked with one hand and held a weapon in the other. Now, when I read that, I think, wait a minute. You can't work on a wall with one hand, and you can't hold a weapon with the other. Somebody came and attacked, and you got one hand on a weapon. I hope you could recover fast enough to handle it. Well, Gill has the answer to that problem. He says that verse 17 is spoken proverbially, not literally. You can't work well or fight well with just one hand, as Gill says. And so this is just a proverb or a manner of speaking. They were ready to go one way or the other. They probably had their weapons right nearby. In fact, verse 18 says each of the builders had his sword strapped around his waist while he was building. And so he would use both hands to work. And then if an enemy come, he'd just grab his sword and start hacking. Verse 18 also mentions that Nehemiah had a trumpeter beside him. What would be the purpose for that? Well, to give the alarm for war. Should the occasion demand it, Nehemiah would blow the trumpet. And we'll see how that would work here as we read verses 19 through 22. I, Nehemiah, said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we carried on the work with half of them, half of the Jews, holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. In other words, from morning till night. So not only did each worker have a spear strapped to himself, but there were a lot of Jews that were just standing at military alert, holding the spears, not working. That would make the job, of course, even more onerous. Verse 22, at that time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. Now verse 19, once again we see Nehemiah speaking to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. The nobles would be the wealthy people. The officials would be the big shots in the government. The rest of the people would be the common laborers. He says, and notice that this rebuilding was done by all sections of society. Everybody was all for one and one for all. We're going to build this wall. So Nehemiah tells them, if you hear the trumpet, rally to us there. If the Jews didn't concentrate their forces, their enemies could pick them off in detail one by one. So Nehemiah is going to counteract that by a signaling procedure here to bring people to the sound of the guns, if you will. And verse 22, Nehemiah says to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem. Now remember, there were a lot of the workers who came from country towns and villages outside of Jerusalem. And instead of having them go back to their homes at night, Nehemiah says, no, you just stay right here inside the walls here inside of Jerusalem with your servants so you can guard it for us at night. And you could work for us by day and then stay at night. Now, of course, I'm sure that one worker didn't stay up all day and all night. I'm sure they divided the work out. But the point is that all these people from outside of Jerusalem would be available within the walls so that they could split up, some work during the day and some guard at night. We go now to Nehemiah 4, verse 23, and we will finish this chapter. So neither I, Nehemiah, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us removed our clothes. Each took his weapon, even to the water. Now, who were Nehemiah's brothers that are referred to here? John Gill says he's referring to the nobles and rulers of Israel. Nehemiah refers to his servants. That would be his domestic servants. I don't know whether they were slaves or free men. I don't know. Nor the men of the guard removed their clothes. Now, the men of the guard, John Gill says, would be Nehemiah's Persian bodyguard who attended Nehemiah for reasons of state and also for grandeur and glory, the guard that had come from Persia when Artaxerxes had sent Nehemiah to Jerusalem. None of those guys removed their clothes. Why? As John Gill says, the clothes were kept on so that the principals there would be ready for any battle that might ensue. So it is possible they went for 52 days without changing their clothes or taking a bath, and you say, oh, that's horrible. Well, you know, not really. Lots of soldiers have done that throughout history. And by the way, how do I know it took 52 days to build the wall? Because Nehemiah 6:15 tells us that. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. Now, the last part of this verse is very difficult to translate because the Hebrew is obscure. The New American Standard Bible says that each of these people took his weapon even to the water. Well, the NIV note says the meaning of the Hebrew here for this clause is uncertain. And the note further says all interpreters have been puzzled with this vexatious clause. Well, fortunately, no great doctrinal belief turns on how we translate this. But let me give you some options. The King James says, each removed his clothes, saving that everyone put them off for washing. In other words, they kept their clothes on except the clothes they took off for washing. And I don't think that's good because that's not really telling you anything. Well, of course you're going to take your clothes off for washing. So what's the point of mentioning that? What's the point of Nehemiah even mentioning that? So I don't think that's it. The King James margin has, everyone went with his weapon for water. Now that sounds more like it. In other words, even when they went to drink water, they took a weapon with them. They had their weapons with them all the time. Now, the American Standard Version and the Bible in Basic English agrees with the KJV margin there. The Darby translation, which I'll give you in just a minute, the Darby note says that probably the version that says, the King James Version that says everyone put their clothes off for washing is probably from a corrupt reading of the text. The Holman Christian Study Bible says each carried his weapon even when washing. So that's a little variation on my second option. The KJV margin says everyone carried his weapon when he went for water. The Holman Christian Study Bible says everybody carried his weapon when he was washing his clothes, which of course would involve water, but not water for drinking, but water for washing. So there's another option. The Darby translation simply has everyone had his weapon on his right side. The New American Bible says the same thing, essentially. The God's Word translation says, we each kept our weapons at hand. The Young's Literal translation says, each hath his vessel of water. So, who knows what Nehemiah meant to say here. I just think it's simpler to say that even while they were going to the water, either for washing or drinking, it doesn't matter. They always had their weapons there. If you look, take all these translations together, the common denominator is the weapon stayed at the right hand of the soldiers. Excuse me, they weren't soldiers. They were the people. It's kind of like a citizen militia. They were ready, in other words. Now, the sermon applications of this are numerous. Of course, I'm sure you've heard many sermons about building the walls for God and being ready at all times, warding off the attacks of the enemy. Well, with that triumphant note, we have now finished Nehemiah chapter 4. In our next audio, I will turn to Nehemiah 5, verses 1 through 19. I will entitle that chapter, Nehemiah Helps the Poor. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.